Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Okay, guys, I teased this at the beginning. I would love to go more personal now. So, Brian and Spencer, what, you know all this stuff. You've looked at religion, your own religion, Mormonism, from academic studies. You know the dose course from both the inside and the outside, the devotional and the objective as much as possible. How has it affected your faith? How has it affected your own Mormonism? What has been the gains and what have been the losses?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, there are different, you know, Brian's point about different places that Mormon studies happen. You know, BYU, where I teach, is deeply invested in the way the faith is talked about and represented in public, in the academy. You know, for reasons that relate directly to the LDS Church and to the life of faith, BYU is as concerned with what we might call spiritual formation, but more so than the academic study of Mormonism, you know, per se. And so, being at BYU where I am forces some real explicit questions on those of us in Mormon studies about the way that the life of the mind relates to, you know, individual piety and experience and, you know, one's own religious life. That's inescapable at BYU. That's what we do. It's in the air. We talk about it. And I'm very candid with my students about it. And that's been a wonderful part of being at BYU for me, and that is that I work these things out publicly in a community that I'm committed to. And so this isn't just kind of a private kind of abstraction for me. It's I have to represent the faith with all of the academic integrity that is incumbent upon anyone who's committed to the life of the mind at all. But at the same time, I'm invested in the community too. And I'm not simply standing outside the community, looking over at it or down at it from a perspective of just mere criticism. You know, I come to my criticism, meaning my intellectual engagement, from a position inside as well. And so, you know, Ann Taves, who was at CGU for years and is now at UC Santa Barbara, she gave a great address a while back about, you know, the problem isn't being a member of a faith community studying faith. The problem is when we don't kind of take notice of audience and the forms of discourse that we're using and the way and what, you know, what authority is at play in our various worlds, you know. And so at BYU, these worlds are kind of jumbled for me. Mm-hmm. And early on, that could be difficult. I mean, when I was first came to BYU, I was in the religion department, which is really built around the model of spiritual formation. That's what it does. But I was fresh out of graduate school, and I came in with all these, you know, all this energy and all these ideas about the ways in which I wanted to get my students ready for the academic study of religion. And it was a very wise and very patient department chair, the late Paul Peterson.
Oh, I love Paul.
Yeah, just a great guy. I'll never forget it, sitting in his office and him saying a phrase that will make anyone with any knowledge of Mormon history kind of chuckle. He said, hey, Professor Fluman, your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you. You know, he just said, listen, this is, we're about, we're not using these words, but we're about spiritual formation here, in a way. We're transmitting the faith, you know, reasonably, hopefully, you know, academically and intellectually, kind of respectfully, but we're conveying the faith, you know. And so, you know, that was, I was committed to that, but I had all that kind of intellectual energy too that spilled beyond those parameters. I wanted to, mm-hmm. I wanted to delve into the intellectual problems that I had been working on for so long as a graduate student. Well, I've found places and ways to do that. I mean, easily, you know, and it's been rewarding that way. But some of us are just wired such that we have to engage our faith in this kind of unrelentingly rigorous way. I'm just made that way, and so I wouldn't know how to do it otherwise. But there are lots of fellow travelers for me within this community, within the LDS community. I'm not at a loss for fellow travelers. I am very comfortable with non-academic Mormons too. I am. I haven't always been, but I am now. But I've got lots of folks who are interested in the kinds of questions that I have, and you know, BYU offers that to me. I've met a lot of people who don't have that and feel very isolated, very alone in their congregations, their community, or whatever else. And I feel for that. I mean, I really do. I think that can be a very lonely and very difficult thing when you feel like you're the only person asking these kinds of questions or wondering about how these two things fit or whatever, you know. But I don't feel that. And maybe in a way I suspect that it's kind of my Mormon studies crowd that provides that kind of level of connection for me. So it's raucous and it can be tension filled and so on, but it's kind of a lovable kind of raucous, tension filled thing to me. It's kind of adorable in its own way. I mean, you know, and so I've found folks who I consider fellow travelers. I mean, you know, Brian and I mean, you know, we're across town, a private religious, you know, LDS institution and state school, guy. And we, you know, we've found a lot of ways to collaborate. We've found a lot of ways to where our institutions can do things that the others can't. And we've, In a way, I think we've established a really interesting model of cooperation. We've got a fantastic relationship with UVU, both in terms of the Maxwell Institute and in terms of my little parts of BYU. And I think that's really instructive. Here are two institutions with very different tasks, and two guys with very different backgrounds in some ways, but we overlap in meaningful ways, and it's been an incredible strength. To me, I mean, it's just marvelous to have someone like Brian right across town. It's marvelous.
Awesome, thank you.
Well,
I may have some follow-ups for you too, Spencer. But let's go, Brian, jump in.
Well, that's well said, Spencer, and the feeling is mutual. I feel like my friends in the Mormon studies community are really important, not only you know for the life of the mind and for working on something exciting together, but just a community of friends that cooperate and collaborate. I think we've seen so much of that over the years, and I think that has really helped this area grow and has helped more students feel comfortable wanting to pursue it. Something came to mind when you were talking about the situation at BYU and your own place in it. You may recall the meeting we had probably around 10 years ago where a group of us at UVU, including Jack Christensen, who at the time was the director of the LDS Institute of Religion there, and Boyd Peterson, called this meeting with the brass at BYU to talk about Mormon studies. And our question for them was, well, where does BYU see itself in the development of this area? As I recall, Spencer, it was just after the CGU chair, the Claremont chair, had been announced.
Yeah.
And so we had around 12 or 14 people in the room, and it really was a diplomatic meeting in which our question to BYU was, you know, where do you see yourself and how can we work together? And I recall that the answer back to us was something along the lines of, we think that what you're doing there is terrific and what other institutions are doing is terrific, but we as an institution have chosen just not to pursue that path, at least at this moment. And we can work quietly and cooperatively, but it would have to be, you know, on a case-by-case basis. And that was very helpful, but it's just interesting to see what a decade does in terms of a growing field of study and the need that was felt by the leadership of the Maxwell Institute and the leadership of BYU to really be part of the conversation. And I think that the niche that they've carved out for themselves there is appropriate to the mission of BYU and the Maxwell Institute, but also very helpful in the field. So I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Spencer, but that was another important moment in the development of what we've been doing.
Well, and the only thing I'm thinking of as you're saying that is the, I mean, where you're talking about institutions, I'm thinking too about a given LDS congregation. And, you know, not everyone approaches their faith the same way. Not everyone experiences it the same way, certainly. I mean, there's a high degree of, you know, cultural conformity, especially on the Wasatch Front, that's encouraged and understood and practiced by Latter-day Saints. But, you know, even then, it's still just wide diversity of the way people experience their faith. And, you know, and for some, the kinds of, you know, rigorous and intellectual approaches to Mormonism, they want it, they need it, they're going to connect to it. And so whatever happens in terms of Mormon studies, just because the Mormon Studies Review, you know, is oriented towards the academy, there will always be a need for that other direction. And just because we're not doing it at the review doesn't mean we don't see the need for it or value it, because lots of Latter-day Saints need and want the other direction, the translation toward them of that life of the mind.
Yeah,
that's a part of the faith. I don't think it's ever been dominant, but it's always been there. It'll always need to be there. And for folks like me, it's indispensable. You know, I spent last week at Stanford in their archives, reading through letters, from a muckraking journalist, Latter-day Saint of the early 20th century, and his correspondence between LDS church leaders. And I was struck by the way that what they were debating. Here are these, you know, very bright, highly educated. He was a graduate of Stanford himself, and he carries on a correspondence between Widso and James Talmadge and B.H. Roberts and Heber J. Grant, Joseph F. Smith. And, you know, their level of exchange, it was amazing to me. I was like, this is not a level of discourse that all Latter-day Saints would expect from church leaders of the, you know, 19-teens. But it was, you know, high level, incredible reasoning. I mean, just well informed, very aware of the life of the mind and its, you know, permutations and contestations in their context. And it was, I just thought, you know, this is indispensably part of the faith, of the tradition. This is part of what it means to be a Latter-day Saint. It just is. Not for everyone. That's okay. I don't need everyone to feel strongly about it the way I do. But it's somewhere in the DNA there.
Nice.
And it's exciting. It's exciting.
I hope you'll do something with that research.
Yeah, I am. I'm writing the biography of James E. Talmadge.
Ah.
And so I was there. This particular journalist turns out to be one of Talmadge's sharpest critics. And so it was an unexpectedly rich collection of correspondence. And so, yeah, that will appear at some point, Dan. Coming soon to a shelf, a bookshelf near you.
Nice, nice. Brian, that was a good, and you were responding to something at the tail end of Spencer's comment, but I got to turn the microphone back to you, and you got to go personal here, brother.
Oh, well,
to whatever degree you were. I mean, how has your life as a Mormon benefited from engaging in all these areas? Is it translated to a different type of faith or a different kind of settling into your Mormon skin or something?
Well, I don't think that anyone can pursue Mormon studies in a very focused and passionate way without being changed and transformed. I also think that, there are things that inform why someone would want to go into the field of study and questions and things that they have. And that was the case with me. I came off of a missionary experience in New York City where the thing that struck me was the diversity of opinions and ideas and ways of living that was for me just unbelievably dizzying. And so I returned back from my mission hungry to understand peoples of different faiths and cultures in a deeper way. And so my faith was more nuanced. It was more qualified as a result of trying to come into contact with and dialogue and try to understand and try to persuade people toward a different way of thinking religiously, and it definitely impacted me. And so my spiritual formation and the development of my academic studies have really gone hand in hand, but my tendency is to be very careful about distinguishing what is personal for me from what I'm teaching in the classroom. And I think that is informed by place, because I teach at UVU, which is approximately 85% LDS, and so there are certain assumptions that students bring to the classroom when you teach, for example, philosophy of religion, or when you teach a Mormon theology class, which is a completely secular religious studies class, but which deals with issues that are deeply held and where students really don't have a context for understanding what is happening when the conversation turns toward ideas and historical events that live in sacred space, and yet suddenly we're talking about them as if they were, sitting alongside, events in the Revolutionary War or the medieval period. And so one of the things that I work hard to do is to try to differentiate between my own biography and the course material. And it's really interesting that we're having this podcast now, because this is the first week of the semester for us. And just yesterday was the first day of my philosophy of religion class, where I spent probably 40 minutes making the distinction between the academic and the devotional study of religion, and what that meant and what they could hope to expect from a philosophy of religion class, and why it was that we're talking about these concepts and these ideas in the way we are. And it's always informative and helpful for me to teach that, because it helps me understand and clarify what it is I'm doing, because I've got young students who are interested in the material, who want to study it more deeply, but who are tentative and don't quite know how to deal with all of this new information and the critical methodologies that are coming to bear on questions of the existence of God and the problem of evil and divine foreknowledge and free will and all these questions that we take up in these classes. And so it's been really helpful for me personally to have an outlet to talk about and think about and come in conversation with people who have the same kinds of questions and ideas and curiosity that I have. But I can do so in a way, because I teach at a state university and I don't have to deal with the kinds of things Spencer has to deal with there. I just have a different set of issues, obviously. That I can be independent. I can express myself in ways that I couldn't otherwise do within a devotional setting. And in an ironic kind of way, that has deepened my faith, and it has helped me maintain a connection to my community in a way that might not otherwise be possible.
Can you push that one a little bit further? That's you're heading right where I want you to head.
Well, it just came back to is there a place where the kinds of questions I have can be dealt with and absorbed and appreciated and respected? And
it's okay that it doesn't happen to happen during Sunday school.
Yes.
Excellent.
Obviously, I would like to see the conversation inside the church be more rich, where people's questions were able to be aired, not only at church, but in other kinds of settings among Latter-day Saints, rather than having to turn to the internet or other sources where they feel like they need to be more private or confidential about it. So I certainly would like to see that happen. But the academic study of religion for me has been the ability to work out some of these questions in a way that has been educationally very productive for me and helpful. It's obviously the way I earn my living and the way I've been able to support my family. And so I've been just very fortunate, very lucky to be able to do what I'm doing and to have the kind of relationship with the friends I have, like you and Spencer and Patrick Mason and Grant Underwood and, Colleen McDaniel and a whole host of other people who have served as a kind of listening post and a community where we're comfortable with each other, even though we come at things in very, very different ways and from very different perspectives. I've been very enthused and encouraged by how supportive this community is, despite the differences between the people who practice it. So,
Nate, thank you. Can I keep you guys on for another 10 minutes? Because let me share a couple of things from my own life of engagement with Mormon studies and my Mormonism. And I'd love to see if this resonates with you, but also it might break open a little bit more in this level of like comfort within your own Mormon skin. So you guys have kind of addressed having a community, having places to do it. Mine was more personal and existential, at least, well, one of the two things I'm going to mention. So if you guys, do you have the extra few minutes?
Yeah, you bet.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. One of the things that helped the heck out of me was studying about other faiths, studying about religion in general, studying about how individuals and other faiths live their faith in all these different ways. Like you were mentioning, Spencer, different temperaments. Some people have to go this direction. Some people are more naturally mystical or contemplative and lean towards this. Some people want black and white, and they're legalistic in their mindsets, and there's other people that are, far more, somehow based just at the, in their lives sort of at a deeper level than ideas. And so seeing all that was just so fantastic for me, and also seeing every religion struggle, was so helpful to me in like making peace with my own Mormonism as just as messed up, just as much on a journey, occupied by the same, range of voices and temperaments and people like that. That was just so key to me to like cut my religion some break. You know, why do you know, you know, you want to think that you're the best, and you want to think that you've, you know, are different than every other religion or something like that. And so there is a period of adjusting to say, my heck, you know, ours is just like the others. You know, I like this about it, I like that about it, I envy this about somebody else, etc. But just to me, it was an important moment in my life to study other religions and just give mine own a break. Does that resonate with either of you guys at all? Is that like... Okay, so go ahead.
No question. In fact, I mean, for me, you know, the field of history did that in the sense that as I started seeing my own faith historically, at first there's that period of, oh,
damn!
We really say that? We didn't, there's no way we could. Oh, how could that? You know.
Yes.
But over time, though, I mean, it actually has helped me be more charitable, not only to folks in the past, but folks in the present. You know, and to kind of historicize myself and us, and say, hey, you know, things are not static in this world. They just aren't. It's always change. But then it invites me to be part of what I regard as, you know, positive change and good change. I mean, so yeah, historicizing things did not destroy my faith. It enriched it for sure for me.
After the immediate readjustment period of, damn it!
Yeah.
Yeah. Brian, anything in that area that resonates?
Well, it has been helpful for me, obviously, to satiate that hunger I had, like I mentioned, you know, coming back from my missionary experience and looking to study other religions more deeply. And what I discovered is something along the lines of what you discovered, which is that every tradition has its challenges. Every tradition has its historical trajectory and that it needs to be dealt with. And so that was very helpful as well for me. What I found is that the questions across traditions are very similar, but the way in which they're dealt with is very different. So if you compare, you know, the Catholic tradition, you know, they have a long tradition and history of the relationship with the theologian and the life of the mind and what it means. And Mormonism, by contrast, doesn't have that tradition of the theologian, where you have an kind of institutional, recognized professional core of academics who are helping the leadership of the church thinking through the faith. And obviously, they've had some challenges negotiating that relationship, but we don't have that kind of situation. And as we grow as an institution, that seems to me to be one of the questions that's very ripe for discussion, is just what will the relationship be between academics within Mormonism and those outside of Mormonism who study in the field. And the leadership of the church. I think there's clearly been an impact lately with the publication of the Joseph Smith papers and these gospel topics essays, where there's greater recognition for the work of scholars and their contribution and what they might add to the church and the culture of the church more generally. But it remains to be seen where that is headed and how far that will go and how much Mormonism will rely on the elements in its history that are cautious and suspicious of over-intellectualizing, from their standpoint, questions that arise in church history and in LDS theology and other areas.
Nice. Thank you. Good extensions. My other area, and again, I'm hoping still to maybe even get you guys, if this will trigger something in you, in this sort of general, you know, personal kind of thing. It was really helpful for me, and you guys have mentioned the term methodologies, you know, quite a bit throughout this. It's important for me to see religion studied from a whole different bunches of fields, you know, anthropological approaches, sociological approaches, philosophical approaches, psychological approaches, gender studies, all those different things. And to me, it was so helpful that I was able to say, look at this lens. This is a powerful tool. It shines a light and it illuminates certain things in a brilliant, brilliant way. But then you could also see the danger of overemphasizing that one tool or overemphasizing that area that's lit up and, you know, the attempt to sort of totalize from, you know, this is the key way to study religion or this is the key way. And so by seeing all those lenses approaching religion in general and other religions, I was much more comfortable for to see them approach Mormonism. But I was also just, I think this is the point I'm really trying to get to, is I'm grateful that when I see things that challenge Mormonism from certain fields, I'm able to now say better, okay, that's important, good, but limited. You know, that approach can only go so far. And I'm also a little bit easier to say, okay, that's a pure category mistake. They're asking a question from this field and expecting an answer in the realm of the spiritual or the realm of, you know, something that's more metaphysical or something like that. Or, you know, like Brian, you talked about the nature of religious experience and things like this, you know, to ask certain questions of it are just not going to yield satisfying results. And so it's just so much easier for me having, you know, kind of played and looked at all these different things to kind of see what's going on, and it makes me more immune or less susceptible to I don't know, I don't want to name particular things that are happening in Mormonism today, but to me, just bad thinking that's trying to totalize from one perspective or another. Does that make any sense to you guys too? Was that helpful along your way, and does it prompt any other reflections?
It does for me. It reminds me of an experience I had in graduate school and that I've had several times since. There's kind of an assumption on the part of both some within the church and some and many outside it that advanced, you know, academic training kind of points towards skepticism and diminishment of faith. It certainly hasn't happened with me.
Right, me either. And maybe it was in danger of that for 6 months, you know, but yeah, but ultimately it wasn't. Yeah,
I haven't experienced that. I'm more deeply Mormon than I've ever been. You know, I mean, I am comfortably LDS and that academic training didn't undo that. But you know, I had an interesting experience studying Jonathan Edwards in graduate school, the great Puritan theologian, maybe the America's greatest theologian, many think so, and just a brilliant, brilliant mind and a heart that just beat with God, an amazing soul to try and comprehend. And so I'm watching Edwards do all sorts of very, again, high level intellectual for his time academic work, you know, updating Puritan metaphysics with you know what we'd call now, you know, cutting edge thinking, right? But there'd be these moments in his writing and in his preaching too, where he would call himself, maybe, but certainly his readers and his hearers, back to a kind of sobering realization that with all of his reading and study and intellectual work, there was still wonder. And he would kind of underscore in these kind of interesting ways to the young graduate student in me the insufficiency of reason, that reason was indispensable, and he would be the the last to disparage it, and I would be the last to disparage reason. But he was very kind of humble.
Yeah, it only goes so far.
About its insufficiency in terms of both being a fully realized human being and in comprehending the world that we find ourselves in. And I've had that experience so many times. Academic training hasn't disenchanted the world for me. And I still see wonder here. And there is still, you know, awe for me that points to God and in all sorts of ways and so on. So I suppose there could be a lot of ways to comprehend experiences like mine. But for me, it's been such a soul satisfying way to be in the world, to be what a non-Latter-day Saint colleague of mine once described me as, a thinking Mormon, which seemed like a backhanded compliment.
Right, yeah.
Right? You know, she's, a knowing Mormon is another way she phrased it, you know. And it's been a soul-satisfying way to be in the world for me. It just has been. And so that's what it made me think of, you know, is that I'm never going to stop approaching the world intellectually. I can't do it. It's not something I can turn off. It's just so fundamental the way I am in the world. But at the same time, there's something. Only so far does it take me.
Wonderful, thank you, brother. Brian, anything coming up for you?
Well, I appreciate what Spencer said. The kind of work that I do lends itself to the kind of personality I have, I guess, in this regard, which is to say that doing philosophy of religion and comparative theology, I find myself as the person who is always asking the questions. But what about this? But what about this? If that is true, what are the implications in other areas of thought? And what I have found, and even in listening to Spencer talk, was for me, a more unsettled place about the questions that have come to bear on religion, not just Mormonism, but just, you know, religiosity in general, and the need to be more humble and to listen more carefully and to try to understand the depth of the other and what other people are trying to say and how they've thought through their faith, and the need to try to integrate it and absorb it and try to construct or put together a view of the world that maintains integrity to my own faith tradition, but also takes account of a variety of other ways of being human, and to not dismiss those too quickly in trying to connect them or to integrate them in this broader narrative of the human experience that we all share together. So my faith has definitely been more humbled and chastened as a result of the kinds of questions that I face that have come about as a result of my intellectual curiosity and my interest in other areas. But it never has been faith destroying. It just has required more effort on my part and a more nuanced understanding of my faith. And I'm much more quiet about these things than people expect me to be, in part because sometimes I'm just so befuddled by something that I just don't even know what to say about it.
I love that self-reflection. We were your friend Jeff and I were teasing you about that last week, weren't we? Just about Brian doesn't show his cards, his own personal cards, as much.
Well,
but
it's been an ongoing conversation between you and me for many, many years, and I think it's reflected in the kinds of things we've studied and the kind of temperament
for sure, for sure.
But it's what's great is that I love and appreciate so many different ways of thinking,
and I recognize that.
And the different personal stories and approaches, and that's why it's been so fun to be at the place I'm at, because I get to work with people who are involved in the Institute of Religion, my BYU colleagues. I get to work with friends in the academy and people who have no faith at all, and to have such a rich diversity of friendships, and to be able to feel comfortable with all these different ways of thinking has just made my life all the more richer.
Awesome. Well, I will let you guys loose. Thank you so much for this conversation. I want to say one more thing and then just kind of do the heading out of town here. One thing is just a quick reaction to you, Spencer. You said you'll always approach it with your mind. You'll also love this engagement. One of the things I've been trying to articulate more and more to folks is, I think sometimes when, you know, our minds come on board and we begin to see discrepancies in either history, or we see inconsistencies in doctrine, or we see personal foibles of leaders and things like that, it's such a head experience. You know, it's such a thing where the mind kind of leads out. And I think there's a sense that can kind of happen is, well, I'm betraying my mind. I'm betraying this intellect that I have if I were to relax into pure devotion again, or if I were to open myself up to, you know, not making the question of truth paramount in my life, and instead making love or making connection or community, something like that. And so what you kind of said there, you'll always do this and yet you'll always run into the limits. That's just, I guess, a thing I just wanted to echo there. I have found it completely to be the opposite when I let myself into these devotional spaces, when I let myself into my contemplative minds, when I, you know, quiet the intellect just for a minute. When I come out of that, guess what? My intellect's sharper. You know what I mean? My the lenses have been wiped clean in some ways from just having that moment of stepping away from it. And so I don't know if you would even agree with that or something like that, but that was just the thing I wanted the audience to listen to hear me on, is that it's not a betrayal to your mind to also try to be a person of praxis, a person of community, a person of service, and all those things. Those intellectual questions will be there, and I just think you have more resources in which to approach them afterwards, if you keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's great.
Hey, you guys have been amazing. Thank you so much. I am going to link to some other podcasts that we've done on Mormon Matters that kind of relate to this. You mentioned Laurie Maffley Kipp, Spencer. We had her on with Doe Daughtry and Margaret Toscano about teaching religion and Mormonism as a religion. I want to link to that. I want to link to several other ones that relate to this. If you guys had, are there a couple recommendations that you guys would have for somebody who wants to kind of check into this? So besides those first couple volumes of the journal, Spencer, favorite books?
Well, I mean, there are books that are, I think, representative of where the field's going. But in terms of books that kind of map out the field, not really yet. I mean, we've got some anthologies that are beginning to do it, or at least beginning to look at. Steve Taysom edited a collection of essays that I think that he would say would represent a certain kind of set of directions for Mormon studies. Quincy Newell edited a collection of essays that I think she would articulate as doing the same thing. And so there are some of those things popping up for sure. But in terms of kind of monographic looks at the field, not necessarily yet. Though I will say I noted that one of Laurie's students, John Charles Duffy, wrote a dissertation yes. about the field a little while ago, and I thought, you know, in that moment, I thought, okay, when folks are writing dissertations about a field, it looks like you've got a field.
Ah, nice.
Right? I mean, that was a particular moment to me in terms of my own kind of survey of things developing, is once you get a kind of high-level dissertation at a top research institution about a field, it's officially a field. I mean, I think we could. I don't think John Charles would mind me pitching his work in that way. But I think that was a kind of moment in and of itself. But I mean, there are certainly books. I mean, the classic kind of religious studies take on Mormonism has got to be Jan Shipp's book back in the 80s. I mean, that
Mormonism, Story of a New Religion.
In its interdisciplinary and theoretical orientation, I think in a way we could probably trace Mormonism 2.0 or Mormon Studies 2.0 rather to that book in some ways. I mean, I think that would please Jan as well to hear me say it, but I think in some ways it might be true. And there are certainly, I mean, I just David Howlett's book on the Kirtland Temple, I think, is a really interesting kind of Mormon studies take on a topic that is in some ways traditional in terms of the study of Mormonism. But I think David's work, kind of represents this is how this is going to look. You know, a more theoretical, interdisciplinary. I would hold up his book as a really interesting way forward.
Nice, Brian. Anything?
Well, I agree with what Spencer said. I think that there are a number of volumes that model religious studies at work, and not so many that make the field, you know, their primary object. So perhaps a couple to add to that would be Armand Moss's Angel in the Beehive, where it really does model a sociologist's mind at work on key areas of Mormon history and thought and practice. That's one that I would have students begin with if they were choosing a top five. I think Phil Barlow's Mormons in the Bible
is
another very important contributor to the field. Obviously, Jan Shipp's Mormonism was really seminal in many respects to it as well. Coming out of my area of study, which is much more underdeveloped than it should be, but I think Sterling McMurrin's Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion helps people to understand, you know, how comparative theology and philosophy of religion can come into play. So those are just a few, but you know, each year there are more and more volumes that are being published, and it's harder to keep up with each of these and to read them all and read the reviews, which in a way is exciting, but it makes it more difficult for those of us in the field who are trying to catch up.
Yeah, in fact, let me add just a couple of titles as indicative of another part of Mormon Studies 2.0, as Brian has dubbed it. Sally Gordon's book on constitutionalism and polygamy, Kathleen Flake's book on the Smoot hearings, and Jared Farmer's book on Mount Timpanogos. All three of those are excellent. Great minds at work, great writers in terms of their craft. But all three, using Mormonism to ask broader questions about American identity or history or, you know, legal history, that's one of the hallmarks of Mormon Studies 2.0 as well, is where Mormonism is used to open up new insights into other things as well. And that's what made it so kind of interesting to non-Latter-day Saints as well, is the way in which these kinds of works make it relevant to several fields often at once, and certainly all three of those do. I mean, Jared Farmer's is kind of a dazzling interdisciplinary take on what, I mean, you know, a single mountain in Utah. You wouldn't imagine that this would be a kind of jumping off point to the insights that he draws out. I think that's what we're going to see in the future. Is great work in which Mormonism is used to examine things apart from Mormonism as well. I think that's where it can be so theoretically rich.
Dan, I'm sitting here thinking, as we've been talking about all these volumes, a story came to mind during that NEH seminar at UVU that first year, I remember how excited Gene England was about this young scholar named Terrell Givens and how he had just published Viper on the Hearth. And I had not yet heard of Terrell and hadn't met him yet. And to our delight, he was able to come to UVU and share his ideas. And the body of work that he has produced since that time, I think Viper was a very important work in its own right in terms of Mormon literary studies and Mormon history, he's the most prolific writer in Mormon academic circles right now. And I think that his latest work, Wrestling the Angel, is another fine example of someone who's doing interdisciplinary work that Spencer mentioned, the importance of interdisciplinarity and how it bears on this field, but with an eye toward theological studies, particularly for this book. So,
Nate. And Terrell is actually going to be the podcast after you guys. So sometime next week, we'll release a thing that he did that I'm helping to release and get into the world. So exciting. Hey, thanks, you guys. You've been on about an hour longer than we kind of planned, so I appreciate that. You guys are both amazing friends, wonderful thinkers. You're so articulate. You make me sick. I just wish that I could approach that, but thanks again for being on.
Well, it's great to be with you, Dan. Always good to be with you and Spencer.
Thanks to both of you.
Listeners, thanks for hanging in here. I hope you've enjoyed this discussion as much as I had hosting it. Please come to the website and share your experiences, your own thoughts, your own engagements with studying Mormonism from academic lenses or translating Mormonism towards academic audiences and things like that. Share anything objective and descriptive, but also feel free to go personal like we did for this last hour here. While you're there, feel free, please, to donate to the podcast. It's so wonderful to have your subscriptions and just your little attaboys. Way to go, Dan. Let's keep this going, kind of one-time contributions. So both those options are there. And I want to remind you to, I'll link to the books that we talked about here today, but I'll link to them through the Mormon Matters bookshelf that's part of the Amazon Associates program. But so any time you spend money, or any time you buy a book through the Mormon Matters site, I get a piece of the action on that, so that's wonderful. But also there's just plain out an Amazon link that you can go to Amazon from the Mormon Matters site, and then any shopping you do, whether it's related to Mormonism or books or, you know, buy your clothing, buy your computer supplies or whatever from it, and a piece of that goes to Mormon Matters as well. So I just appreciate this audience so much, appreciate the chance to be in your ears and parts of your drive time and your exercise time and your lawn mowing and all the different ways that people tell me they mostly listen to this. It's a real privilege, and I'm just grateful to you all. Wish y'all a wonderful day, and we'll sign off with the typical cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.